Thanks so much. And thanks for all of your compliments and contributions to the conversation this afternoon. I'll be back tomorrow from 4 with the Nation's live conversation across the day's politics, current affairs and culture on Drive. I'm Andy Park. Stay tuned for PM.
Hello, welcome to PM. I'm Rachel Mealy, coming to you from the lands of the Turrbal and Yuggera people in Brisbane. Tonight, Australian rock lobster is back on the menu in China after Beijing lifts its ban. What's the industry's reaction? Also, Hurricane Milton makes landfall in Florida, leaving a trail of destruction and flood warnings in its wake. And tourists are flocking in big numbers to Indigenous cultural sites across the country. Aboriginal guides are relishing the chance to share their stories.
It's starting to really ramp up. Our days are ended on such a high because you've helped people to connect. You've shared your culture in very different positive ways.
China has agreed to lift a ban on Australian live rock lobster imports after a meeting between the Prime Minister Anthony Albanese and Chinese Premier Li Qiang. Rock lobster trade was suspended at the height of the pandemic, along with a number of other goods, including beef, barley and wine, when Australia's relationship with China deteriorated. Rock lobsters were the last industry locked out of China as restrictions on other goods ended. After years of struggle, crayfishers are cautiously optimistic about today's announcement. Sarah Maunder reports.
John Hyam has been a crayfisherman since he was a teenager. When China introduced bans on Australian rock lobsters back in 2020, it ended his work overnight.
Straight away, right, literally overnight. The next morning we went out there, pulled the bites, threw all the crayfish back in the water and that was it. Finished.
John Hyam is based in Geraldton, Western Australia. When the rock lobster market dried up, he expanded his net fishing, but it's been a tough few years.
So I was doing my commercial net fishing just to make ends meet. Yeah, I'm only a small fisherman, but like the bills just keep coming and coming, and yeah, there's just nothing in it. There's no money in it. It's just, it got to a stage where it was really hard.
Today it was announced that rock lobster farmers will be able to resume exporting to China before the Chinese New Year. Although he's happy with the development, John Hyam will wait and see what happens.
Oh, unbelievable. Good news. Going to create more jobs. It's just going to be, we'll see what happens. A bit exciting. Hopefully go back to higher prices and, you know, more jobs.
You probably haven't even had a chance to think about this yet, but will you invest more or pivot back to lobsters now that the ban has been lifted?
I think it will probably, after a few months, you know, you'll start seeing, like, once the whites start coming, there might be a better price. There should be a better price coming up. So we'll see what happens with that. Obviously the crew, like deckies, their pays are going to go up, which is a big thing because it's very hard to get crew, you know, at the moment. Once there's better money in it for crew and, you know, for other people, it's going to be a lot better.
The lifting of the lobster export suspension follows the removal of bans and tariffs on other Australian products, including timber, barley, wine, coal and cotton. Back in May, China lifted a ban on 5 Australian beef exporters. Prime Minister Anthony Albanese announced the agreement on lobsters today after meeting with the Chinese Premier Li Qiang at the ASEAN summit in Laos.
We have continued to stabilise the relationship without compromising on any of Australia's national interests. With our patient, calibrated and deliberate approach, we've restored Australian trade with our largest export market.
Kiri Tomasos is a director of Seafood Industry Australia and an executive of the South Australian Northern Zone rock lobster fishery. He says it's been a difficult time, but the industry is resilient.
We looked at all the other opportunities that existed, as well as we're always committed to our local market and our local consumption. We have done the best we could with the operating environment that we had.
Anthony Albanese has identified that all this will be resolved before the Chinese New Year, which I think is at the end of January 2025. How are you feeling about that timeline?
We are really, really positive. You know, it's something that at least now we have a timeline to work towards. We are very eager to engage as strongly as possible. And I think both state and federal government is going to really, really assist in the process. We here in South Australia, we have a very, very supportive government, and our trade minister, Minister Sakash, is fully committed and supportive of that process. So we're really fortunate to be in this space.
I guess you'll be making a couple of very happy phone calls this afternoon and later this evening.
Absolutely. The story is very positive, and it's something that we have been looking forward to. But again, we are very grounded in our approach, and we're going to work collaboratively with our federal government for that process to be as smooth as possible.
Kerry Tomasos from the South Australian Lobster Industry, that report there by Sarah Maunder. It's been a sleepless and difficult night for many in the US state of Florida as Hurricane Milton made landfall. It was originally a Category 5 system, but crossed the west coast of what's known as America's Panhandle as a Category 3 and has since been downgraded. Several people are reported to have died, and forecasters are warning of dangerous storm surges in the wake of the hurricane. Close to 2 million homes across the state are currently without power, and while it's still too early to know the damage, it's expected to run into the billions of dollars. Isabel Masali reports.
In Pinellas County, about 100 kilometres north of where Hurricane Milton made landfall, Barbara Hernandez tries to keep calm at an emergency operations centre. They're being inundated with calls for help, and there are still several hours to go. As the county's communications director speaks to the ABC, she explains winds are reaching 144 kilometres an hour, a very dangerous situation.
Unfortunately, with Hurricane Helene, which we are just reeling from Hurricane Helene, which hit our county about 2.5 weeks ago, we did lose 12 lives with that hurricane. It was very devastating. Preservation of life is really our priority. Right now, we're looking at about 700 calls to our 911 center, which takes all of our emergencies that are storm-related. During Helene, we saw a lot of calls from individuals who decided to stay and regretted it, and I had a chance to listen to a lot of those calls, and they are harrowing.
She says they've just had to tell the community emergency crews can't come and provide help until conditions ease.
So we really prepared for this storm, as we do for every one of them. But with Milton being a Category 5 for some period of time before arriving in our state, it really was the storm that everybody dreaded in the USA, especially in Florida. We have not seen the likes of that in Pinellas County in over 100 years.
Milton made landfall as a Category 3 hurricane, but had been approaching Tampa Bay as a Category 5, with winds of almost 250 kilometres an hour. The powerful winds have brought destruction, along with major flooding and tornadoes. While it's too early to know the full scale of the damage, police in Fort Pierce have reported some loss of life. At one point, there were a reported 1.8 million homes and businesses without power across Florida. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis.
Stay inside and stay off the roads. Floodwaters and rushing storm surge are very dangerous. And I would say that's even more so in spite of everything the state did to help these local communities hit by Helene remove a lot of debris. And they did move a lot of debris over the last 72 hours. You're going to have new debris created, and you still have some of that old debris in some of those places. So there's going to be hazards in the storm surge and in the flood waters.
Many evacuated before the hurricane hit, causing traffic jams and fuel shortages. Australian woman Tracy Perrott managed to catch one of the last flights out of Orlando.
As soon as we saw all of this traffic and the everyone being asked to evacuate if you could, we actually tried to call United Airlines and couldn't get through, and sort of thought, wow, we could be stuck here. We went and asked our hotel, but they were fully booked. So our main worry was we were going to be stranded with nowhere to go.
Steve Turton is a professor of environmental science at Central Queensland University. He explains before the hurricane crossed the coast, it not only weakened in severity, but also broadened in area.
Well, obviously the wind damage will be less because the wind speeds are not as great. But the biggest issue from this system will be storm surge, because the storm surge is this wall of water that the cyclone pushes ahead of it as it moves towards the coast. And especially on the south side of the eye, where the winds are coming off the ocean. So you get an additional effect of the wave energy on top of the storm surge. So the storm surge is like, imagine sloshing water across the bath, right? That's kind of what the storm surge is. The cyclone is pushing a wall of water ahead of it. And that wall of water is pushing up against the coast, making its way into all the inlets and bays. What's 3.3 million people live in the path of this cyclone. So it's not an insignificant event by any means.
Dr. Turton says climate change is leading to more intense hurricanes, with more heat going into the ocean.
Hurricanes, cyclones, they're all fed by the ocean heat content. If you've got more energy in the ocean, more heat, you're going to produce these more mega storms that we're seeing popping up all over the world. And the other thing that's interesting about this particular cyclone or this particular hurricane is that it intensified from a Category 1 to a Category 5 in about 11 hours, which is... It's quite mind-boggling to think that something that a system could do that. It almost means rewriting the textbooks, because, you know, meteorologists learn that these things normally need, you know, a way longer period of time to go through such a rapid intensification. So this is a manifestation of global heating being driven by rising greenhouse gases.
Back in Florida, Ron McGill is worried about the increasing intensity of hurricanes and storms. He's at the Miami Zoo, where staff have put in place plans to protect the animals.
Here in our state, we had an issue with the previous governors who refused to even say climate change. You were not even allowed to say it in any of the official documents. Now, finally, it's coming to fruition, but, you know, it's more reactive than proactive. And there's no question that climate change is making a huge change. We have had the hottest temperatures in the written history here at the zoo, here in South Florida. Florida has had extreme rains. We've had, you know, all kinds of things happening, not just in Florida, but throughout the country, throughout the world. And people, I think, now are starting to understand the incredible impact this is going to have, not just on our quality of life, but on survival for a lot of animals, a lot of people, a lot of environments.
That's Ron McGill at the Miami Zoo, Isabel Masali reporting. This is PM. I'm Rachel Mealy. You can hear all our programs live or later on the ABC Listen app. Coming up, there's been a surge in the number of tourists looking to experience Australia's Indigenous culture.
We have cruise ships come through, we have group bookings, we have chartered bookings and private tours, and it's getting really exciting.
Australia's doctors have made a last-ditch appeal to the Northern Territory government not to go ahead with its plan next week to introduce new laws to lower the age of criminal responsibility from 12 to 10. The Australian Medical Association and National Children's Commissioner have blasted it as a regressive step which no one else in the world is taking. They're joined by paediatricians from across the Northern Territory who've written to the Chief Minister calling on her to ditch the plan. Jane Barden reports.
In her job as a paediatrician in Darwin, Catherine Giroz often works with children who have neurodevelopmental conditions, and she says many of them have been in and out of youth detention.
My experience with those patients is that they're extremely traumatised from being in detention. They find detention demoralising, and in fact, their trajectory doesn't change.
Would you even say that the experience of being in detention might even have the potential to make their trajectory worse, particularly at quite a young age?
Definitely. A lot of the children who go into detention often have neurodevelopmental disabilities. They don't understand why they might be in detention. Most of these children come from extremely adverse childhood backgrounds. They've suffered neurodevelopmental trauma. And then on top of that, children suffer from many conditions like fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, intellectual disability. And so really some of these children, you know, by lowering the age to 10, we're not actually charging children who have a cognitive function of a 10-year-old. They will often have the cognitive function of a 6, a 7 or an 8-year-old.
Cuthryn Giroz is among dozens of Northern Territory paediatricians who've signed a letter to the Territory's new Country Liberal Party government, urging it not to go ahead with its plan to lower the age at which children can be imprisoned. That age is currently 12, but the change to be introduced to Parliament next week will bring that down to 10.
Really, I do feel that we're doing harm to these children by lowering the criminal age of responsibility. And so you're perpetuating the problem. I don't think in the long run this is going to solve anything.
The previous Labor government raised the criminal age to 12 2 years ago. It was the first Australian jurisdiction to do so, following the recommendations of the NT's Royal Commission into Abuse in Youth Detention. The ACT followed, and Victoria and Tasmania are making moves towards raising the age. Another Darwin paediatrician, Sophie Dunn, organised the letter. She's worried other jurisdictions could follow the NT's move.
We really hope that the government will listen to experts in the field. It's clear that children that are incarcerated from a younger age have much higher rates of reoffending. So if we're trying to make our communities safer, by locking up children, we're actually really kicking the can down the road.
The doctor's appeal is being backed by the National Children's Commissioner, Anne Hollins, who today blasted the NT plan.
That plan, it's not based on evidence. That's a problem that we're going backwards, and I don't believe that's been done anywhere in the world. So it is a regressive step.
She's calling for a new national approach to youth justice, based on rehabilitating young offenders instead of imprisoning them. Standing alongside her in Canberra was a former youth offender, Tyson, who says he's now turned his life around to become a plumber.
I went through the system at a young age, from 11 to 17. Honestly, I get asked a question a lot. Why did you keep reoffending? My answer to that today, with my knowledge, is they kept locking me up. They kept incarcerating me.
The Royal Australasian College of Physicians is also adding to the pressure. Its paediatrics president is Nitin Kapoor.
In Australia, the age for criminal responsibility should be 14. Northern Territory was a poster child. The government increased the age of criminal responsibility. This is a really backward step.
But the Northern Territory's Chief Minister, Leah Fenocchiaro, is adamant that after her big election victory, she has a mandate from the public to lower the criminal age.
Ignoring young people who are committing crimes is not an answer to turning their life around. And that's why, by lowering the age of criminal responsibility, we can intervene earlier in a young person's life and provide them the support they need to turn a new page and start a better journey of skills training rather than end up in an adult correctional facility.
The NT police regularly catch 10-year-olds stealing cars and breaking into businesses and usually bring them home. Many business people, including Darwin shop owner Jeanette Samaha, support the government's move to lower the criminal age.
I think it's necessary because children are fully aware of what they're doing. Other than that, the consequences should be a little more harsher for them to stop, to have the fear set in them to stop doing these silly, cruel, unnecessary acts of violence, whether it's thievery or hitting someone or stealing their belongings. These kids need to be reprogrammed, and I think 10 is a really good age to start.
Paediatrician Cuthryn Giroz and her colleagues want more responses to youth crime, but they say those responses need to be therapeutic, not punitive, to set troubled children and their families on a better path.
For families who have very low social determinants of health need to come to a hub where they can undergo neurodevelopmental assessment. That does not exist in Darwin currently. Taking a different approach, not this sort of punitive approach, will have better outcomes for these kids and for the community and the safety of the community.
Darwin paediatrician Cuthryn Giroz talking there to Jane Barden. The leading cause of death in Australia is on the brink of change, with heart disease soon to be eclipsed by dementia-related deaths. Deaths from heart disease have fallen over time, and dementia-related deaths have ticked up in number over the past few years. So is this a sign of better health care for heart disease or better detection of dementia across the population? Elizabeth Cramsey reports.
For many years now, Australians have known the leading cause of death has been heart disease, or more precisely, what's called ischemic heart disease.
It covers heart attack, angina, various other conditions that are associated with diseases of the coronary artery that mean that the heart muscle doesn't get enough blood and oxygen. So it's a group of conditions, but of course heart attacks are most dramatic.
Professor Gary Jennings is a cardiologist and the chief medical advisor to the Heart Foundation. He says there have been big developments in recent years to try and tackle Australia's number one killer.
Firstly, better prevention, and particularly the availability of new drugs, for new medications for high blood pressure, for diabetes, for high blood cholesterol levels. As importantly, we're getting better hospital and out-of-hospital treatment of heart attacks, fewer people dying at that stage because of the availability of rather dramatic new treatments to unblock arteries at the time of a heart attack.
But that doesn't mean fewer people are developing heart disease.
In the longer term, we've also got some terrific tools, including cardiac rehabilitation and medications that mean that people that have a heart attack or a stroke or some other major cardiac event are less likely to develop another one. And that's been a significant advance as well. But it does mean more people are living, taking medications, having treatments, having procedures for heart disease, even though they may not be dying at the same rate.
And it's paying off. Data released from the Bureau of Statistics shows Australia's leading cause of death could soon be overtaken. The number of deaths attributed to heart disease is dropping. Lauren Moran is the director of the Health and Vital Statistics section at the ABS.
So that's been the leading cause of death in Australia for a really long time. And that peaked in 1968 and caused over 30% of deaths back then. But now it's been decreasing slowly over time, and we've been monitoring that. And so for this year, it's the closest it's ever been to the second leading cause of death. So it still caused over 16,000 deaths, but it now accounts for about 9.2% of deaths. So a big decrease from back from when it caused over 30%.
But another cause of death, dementia, comes in at second place and is rising fast.
So over time, it's been increasing. So back when, I'm saying, in 1968, when we had that peak of deaths from heart disease, dementia accounted for about 0.2% of deaths, so far less than 1%. And now it accounts for 9.1%. So it's been increasing over time. So it's a really interesting relationship between the two of them. And there's a lot happening behind that change.
Lauren Moran says with an ageing population, it's likely we'll see more people dying from things like dementia, because while age doesn't cause dementia, it is a risk factor.
We're also seeing a tendency for dementia to be written more often on a death certificate by a doctor. So that's something we've seen in the data set. So there's this real change of decrease in heart disease and better treatments, but also this administrative change where we're getting more and more information on that death certificate.
Dr. Cale Stokes from Dementia Australia says the statistics are a reminder of how society is changing.
Dementia is just shy of becoming the leading cause of death. And I think there's only about 250 deaths in it between that and heart disease. It's not a race that people living with dementia particularly want to win, but it is important that we recognise the scope and impact of dementia on our community. There is no cure for dementia. It is already the leading cause of death of women in Australia at the current time.
Dr. Stokes says, like with heart disease, more needs to be done in the prevention of dementia-related deaths.
Still a lot of misunderstanding out there, including the fact that there are modifiable risk factors that together can actually reduce the incidence of dementia by up to 45%.
And she says whether dementia is the leading cause of death or in second place, far too many people are affected.
There are more than 421,000 people that are impacted by dementia and more than 1.6 million people who are involved in their care. So it is absolutely imperative that for a disease that has no cure, we focus on the things that we can do, and that certainly includes the ability to focus on our brain health and reducing risk.
Dr. Cale Stokes from Dementia Australia, ending that report by Elizabeth Cramsey. And you can contact the National Dementia Helpline on 1800 100 500 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Indigenous cultural tourism experiences are riding a boom in New South Wales, with the number of Aboriginal tour guides and visitors to significant sites on the rise. It comes as the state government looks to capitalise on regional tourism. Eliza Getzey reports.
Hearing Bungala woman Emmeline Richards talk about her work taking tourists around South Australia's Eyre Peninsula, you can tell she's passionate about her job.
Our days are ended on such a high because you've helped people to connect. You've shared your culture in very different positive ways.
For Emmeline, the Aboriginal cultural tours she runs with her four children are a tool for education in a region where some of the most violent encounters between First Nations groups and European settlers in the state took place.
I grew up in Port Lincoln, and there's always been a pretty big focus on tourism. But one of the things that we've always noticed is the lack of inclusion of cultural tourism, and in particular, especially in this area of Bungala heritage and culture. Now that's starting to change.
2 years after the tours began, she says the bookings are rolling in faster than ever.
It's starting to really ramp up. We have cruise ships come through. We have group bookings. We have chartered bookings and private tours. And it's getting really exciting.
Indigenous tourism is looking like a ray of light in an otherwise tough period for regional tourism in Australia. Post-pandemic, as many of us find our international travel wings again, domestic visitors to areas like outback Queensland and New South Wales and the Northern Territory have all dropped. But new figures from Tourism Research Australia show a jump in interest in cultural tourism. Its latest national visitor survey reports that in the last financial year in New South Wales alone, more than 800,000 people participated in an Aboriginal tourism experience, spending $3.2 billion. Domestic visitors spent 15% more than the previous year. Kamilaroi tour guide Len Waters takes visitors on his country in the New South Wales New England region. He says tourists today are interested in much more than just the physical beauty of the bush.
The sites are only a portion of that. Really learning about sort of Aboriginal people, their culture and language, their stories and artefacts and what things they're used for, and certainly a lot about the communal astronomy as well, because that's a lot of people sort of like to go on a bit of a tour, but they like to sort of stargazing and following the stories that go with those.
Len says this year he's been connecting for the first time with larger international tourism groups, and his stargazing knowledge has been in demand across other parts of New South Wales.
I think there's been a lot more people that's wanting to find out a little bit more about Aboriginal culture in Australia, and some of these people have been coming from overseas, and yeah, it's been great. And obviously they go away and sort of think, well, wow, you know, sort of they've had a good time and they've learned something. I think that's the main thing.
For Sydney woman Karen Hollander, a visit to Mungo National Park in southwest New South Wales was an opportunity to broaden her understanding of Aboriginal culture.
We just want sort of like more of an Aboriginal sort of perspective on why it's actually significant. We want to learn more about Mungo Man and Mungo Lady. And like at school, I didn't learn much about it. And I think it's pretty cool that we've got the oldest culture in the world. And I want to hear from people who have lived this generation to generations.
Karen isn't the only one. Data from the National Parks and Wildlife Service in New South Wales shows in the past 2 years, the Mungo National Park has experienced an increase in visitors, with overnight stays up by 21%, and the number of people joining cultural tours up by 28%. The cultural tourism boom comes as the New South Wales government sets a target to boost visitor spending across the state to $91 billion per year by 2035. Nearly half of that is predicted to be spent in regional areas. New South Wales Tourism Minister John Graham says there's lots to like away from the city.
Those are things like our incredible food and beverage offerings, outdoor and adventure tourism, some of the festivals or incredible outback festivals that you can attend, or the Indigenous cultural heritage. All of those are on offer right across New South Wales, including in inland New South Wales.
A recent federal parliamentary inquiry made 28 recommendations to better support Australian tourism. One of them was to establish a federal First Nations tourism body to represent the interests of Indigenous businesses and communities in the sector. And it also called for better representation on the Tourism Australia board. Emmeline Richards says while she's seen government support grow for cultural tourism in the last few years, she too wants to see more Indigenous Australians have a seat at the table to shape the industry's future.
what we do need to do is be inclusive. We do need a national body. There does need to be more Aboriginal people, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people that are involved. And it does not have to be the same people that are involved on everything, on every level. We need to be open to people that are actually in tourism, do tourism, and are wanting to help develop cultural tourism better.
Bungala tour guide Emmeline Richardson ending that report by Eliza Getze with additional reporting by Hayley Craig and Tamara Clark. Thanks for joining me for PM. I'm Rachel Mealy. The podcast of the full PM program is available on the ABC Listen app. We'll be back at the same time tomorrow. Good night.
ABC News. Hello, I'm Simon Lauder. Prime Minister Anthony Albanese says China has agreed to lift its ban on Australian rock lobsters on a timetable that will see exports resume by the end of the year. The change was secured after a meeting between the Prime Minister and China's Premier Li Qiang on the sidelines of the ASEAN summit today. It follows the lifting of China's bans on Australian wine, coal, timber and barley. Prime Minister Albanese says the ban will be lifted in time for Chinese New Year.
This will be welcomed by the people engaged in the live lobster industry in places like Geraldton and South Australia and Tasmania and so many parts of particularly regional Australia.
Air safety investigators have found a helicopter pilot involved in a fiery accident in far north Queensland was intoxicated at the time. 23-year-old Blake Wilson died when he crashed onto the roof of a Cairns waterfront hotel in August. He'd taken the chopper from his employer, Nautilus Aviation. Angus Mitchell from the Australian Transport Safety Bureau says a final report has found Mr. Wilson was not authorised to fly in Australia and was under the influence.
The flight was a purposeful act, but there was no evidence to explain the pilot's intentions. So the toxicology report showed high levels of blood alcohol concentration. We do know that the pilot did take significant measures to conceal the nature of their flight, and whilst it was tragic that a young man has lost his life, there was significant risk to others here in the Cairns area.
The lawyer representing a survivor of child